Well, September is Brain Aneurysm Awareness Month. So we decided a good time to talk about this serious condition today. Aneurysms, I guess they happen when part of an artery wall weakens. It may stretch and widen in a way that's not safe for you or for me. And who knows better about it than Dr. Luke Bradbury back with us. He is a neurologist at UW Health, an associate professor of neurology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. So we're going to talk about how to know if you or someone else is having an aneurysm, plus what you can do to prevent one. And I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about aneurysms? Have you experienced one? What did treatment and recovery look like for you? Join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to ideas@WPR.org. ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Luke Bradbury, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
How many people are affected by cerebral or brain aneurysms? Mm-hmm.
So that's a great question. And one of the purposes of awareness months like this, where we try and get the word out and get more education to the public about aneurysms, is that we're hoping we can actually find more before they cause a problem. But right now, it looks like about, you know, in some of the big studies that have done, that about 3% of the population may have an aneurysm. It's probably more than that because there are certainly people who will go their whole life with an aneurysm and never know about it, and it won't ever cause any problems. But we think that at least 3% of the population probably has an aneurysm. And so really the goal is to try and find the aneurysms that might turn into a hemorrhage where they might bleed into around the brain there. And that's referred to as a subarachnoid hemorrhage because of where it happens, sort of between the brain and the where the arteries lie. And so, but it's probably around 3% and maybe a little bit more than that. Yeah.
That's a lot of people.
It is. Yeah. Now the reassuring thing is that only when you look at who actually has a bleed from that aneurysm, it's about 6 out of every 100,000 people. So it's much less. So if you have an aneurysm, it certainly doesn't mean that it's absolutely going to cause a problem, but we need to try and figure out whether it will and then treat it if it's going to.
How do we diagnose it?
So there are two main imaging modalities that we can use to diagnose aneurysms. So the first and most common, I think, one that people will get is called a CT scan. And with a CT scan, that's an X-ray of the brain. So a lot of people have had a CT scan of some sort where you lie on a table and then you go into this tube that shoots X-rays. And what we can also do is inject contrast into the blood vessels. And when that contrast gets into the arteries and you take an X-ray, we can see the arteries very, very well. And when we do that, we can see if there's an aneurysm on one of those arteries inside the skull. Now, the other way is called an MRI scan, and that uses magnets to look at the brain and the blood vessels as well. You don't always need contrast, but sometimes you do. But that will also look at the blood vessels very carefully and show the aneurysms, because these are often very deep inside the skull. And so we need imaging that actually can look through the skull and the brain and actually get to the arteries there.
And I think that doctors are finding more aneurysms before they rupture. Is that right? I wonder why.
That's a great question. And I think there's two main reasons that we can sort of blame right now for finding more. And that the first is that more people are having scans. As you know, they have other conditions, and you know, there more people are going to the emergency department for some reason. They're having a scan, and an aneurysm will be found sort of without actually looking for it specifically. And we call that an incidental finding, where they're looking for something else. Maybe someone has, you know, a different kind of migraine headache, and they go in and they get a scan of their brain. We actually find an aneurysm with that. And so that those sort of incidental findings are one that's increasing the risk or the rate of finding them. Now, the other reason I think we're finding more of them is that our scanners are actually much better. Both the CT scans and the MRI scans over the last maybe 10 years and more have really gotten to the quality is much better than it used to be. And so because of that, we're able to find smaller aneurysms and actually diagnose them before they get to be a big problem. So that's probably another one of the big reasons why we're seeing more. The worry is that we're finding more aneurysms because people have risk factors that they're actually developing those aneurysms more frequently now. And so that's something that with this kind of Aneurysm Awareness Month, we're trying to get people to learn about them and hopefully reduce those risk factors.
Margie in Appleton has a comment for us. Let's go there. Hi, Margie.
Hi. Long-time listener, first-time caller. I love NPR.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm calling because, unfortunately, my mother passed away 10 years ago of stroke and aneurysm. And I remember the doctor telling us that, you know, as you guys get my siblings, you know, as you guys get older, you're going to need to be checked for this. And I was curious about it being how much of it is hereditary and how do I express this to my primary care and when?
Yeah,
That's an excellent question. So there are several factors that go into someone's risk of developing an aneurysm, and there certainly is a hereditary component to that. Right now, when we look at the guidelines and sort of the studies that would suggest who should be screened for an aneurysm, if someone has what we call an immediate family member, in other words, someone who is either your parent or your sibling or your child who has an aneurysm, a first-degree relative, I should say, who has an aneurysm, and especially with a rupture, it's probably worth getting checked. And by that, you can go ask your primary doctor, you know, if you need to get screened, those two methods, either a CT angiogram to look at the blood vessels with the X-ray or an MRI scan that uses a similar sort of way to look at the blood vessels, are both good screening opportunities. They used to think that you would need two first-degree relatives who have had aneurysms to really be worth screening, but I think there's some more recent data that's come out that if you've even had just one first-degree relative with an aneurysm, and especially if it's ruptured, it's a good idea to talk to your primary care doctor about getting screened. The age at which to do that, I don't think there's a very good study or recommendation I have as far as a cutoff, but certainly once you start, because most people will develop aneurysms in somewhere between their 30s and 50s, years old, probably sometime, around, 30 years or older is a good time to get screened for that.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. And Robin in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Robin. Oop, I think we lost Robin. Let's go to Donald in Merrill. Hi, Donald.
Hi. I have a two-part question. Thank you for taking my call. One is there a severity difference between abdominal aneurysms and cerebral aneurysms? And secondly, is there any known relationship of what's called ice pick headaches and cerebral aneurysms? I have what they call ice pick headaches that are, for lack of a better term, extremely painful. And they only last anywhere from 10 seconds to maybe a couple of minutes. But wow, that is a headache that will really, knock you down.
Yeah. All right. So a couple of questions.
Yeah. You're very good points to talk about here. So to start out with the question you had excellent about the abdominal aneurysm. So really any artery in the body could develop an aneurysm, and that's a risk. And the especially the aorta in the abdomen is one place that can develop an aneurysmal sort of problem where essentially the walls are weak and it dilates out. And that too is very dangerous. And the danger from that comes from, if it were to rupture and start bleeding, you can very quickly lose a lot of blood from an abdominal aneurysm. So that's another good thing if you certainly have family members or you're at risk for developing that to talk to your primary doctor and get that diagnosed because there are treatments for that. It's very different, though, in that the cerebral aneurysms are much smaller and can also cause, a big problem. Abdominal aneurysms are usually much bigger. So the size is different, but the risk is very similar in that if bleeding happens, it can, be fatal. And for cerebral aneurysms, about a third of the people who develop a rupture, a bleeding from that, can go on to die. And then another third of the people, if they survive, will probably end up with pretty significant disability. Whereas abdominal aneurysms, it's very, because the bleeding can be so rapid from that, the survival is often very compromised there. The ice pick headaches you're describing are very common, and I almost hesitate to use the word because, as you described, they can be so painful, but they're benign in that they probably don't have an association with something like aneurysms. But it raises a really important point in that when someone has a ruptured cerebral aneurysm, the main symptom they have is very similar to an ice pick headache, where you have what we call a thunderclap onset of the headache pain. It's very, very severe pain, often the worst pain you've ever had in your life, and it comes on very, very suddenly. ice pick headaches, as you've experienced, do last a very short period of time and will go away, and then you're hopefully feeling back to your old self again. Whereas if you have a hemorrhage from an aneurysm, that does not go away, that stays. And so anyone, if you've not had a diagnosis like you have of ice pick headaches, if you develop a sudden, severe thunderclap onset of severe head pain, you need to go to the emergency department immediately.
Immediately. Our guest today, Dr. Luke Bradbury, neurologist at UW Health, and he's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today, by the way. He's an associate professor of neurology at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We'll be talking with him about aneurysms, and certainly we'll be taking your calls. I know we have a lot of people online already. I think there's a line open yet, but just hang in there, and we will be back with Dr. Luke Bradbury right after we find a look at the news and what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network through the day. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Luke Bradbury. He is a neurologist at UW Health, an associate professor of neurology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, and talking about aneurysms, and this is Aneurysm Awareness Month. So what are you doing to lower your chances of having one? Maybe you've had one before. I hope you'll join in. Our lines are filled right now, but you could email us to ideas@wpr.org or give a call at 800-642-1234. And Dr. Bradbury, let's go right back to the phones. Robin in Milwaukee will give you a chance. Hi, Robin. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi there. My question is, I have had three different headache events where headache is just terrible, left side of my face, pressure on my eye, has lasted more than 24 hours, caused like nausea. Went to the doctor. They agreed that I should probably have an MRI with and without contrast. I have second degree relatives on both sides that have had aneurysms or stroke and or both. So when I decided to go ahead and do this, finding out it's very cost prohibitive. It's like $5,000 to have two different types of MRIs done. Just curious what the doctor thinks about, the risk versus, finding out that you might have an aneurysm that hasn't, burst, I guess, or may be bulging versus just, waiting it out and see when the next headache happens. Just curious what your thoughts are on that. Luckily, my doctors were very responsive and, ordered the test and said, yeah, we should check this out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The cost of medical care sometimes is very difficult. I would say if there is any concern at all that you might have had what we call sentinel bleeds, in other words, where there's a small aneurysm that may have had a little bit of bleeding that stopped and can cause pretty severe pain for a while, it is worth getting those scans done. And so I would probably strongly recommend anyone who's had that kind of history like you're describing probably should get a scan. If we're just wanting to rule out aneurysms, then, the CT scan sometimes is cheaper than an MRI scan. It really depends on where you get it and how it's done. But that is a possibility also. Probably one of the other advantages that an MRI scan can have is that if there's other sort of structural changes in the brain or the surrounding structures of the brain, an MRI scan can see that a little bit better, which is often why those are recommended for people with headaches, that we need to look inside the skull and make sure nothing dangerous is happening. I would say, just to revisit, if someone has the sudden onset of a very severe headache, really calling 911 and getting to the emergency department right away, then the scan will be done, I hope, almost as soon as you get to the emergency department should be the protocol really anywhere, to look for an aneurysm, and even a small hemorrhage, a small bleeding part of that aneurysm should be able to be seen with those scans now. So I do encourage you to try and get those scans done, but it is very difficult sometimes with the cost of these tests and what can happen. Insurance companies, I know I've written letters before and I've talked to them about getting scans like this done, and hopefully maybe they can help out a little bit more if that's possible, but it can be difficult.
Robin, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. We have a listener in Chippewa Falls with a question. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions. I was diagnosed with two small aneurysms quite a few years ago, and my father passed from an aneurysm, and my brother had an aneurysm. Mine are small, which the doctor told me are harder to operate on than the big ones. My other question is, well, I had the option of clips or coils or to do nothing. And I'd like to know the prevention of it bursting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when you have, when they have found aneurysms on some of these screening tests that we've talked about, what to do about it is often a very difficult question. And I'll say that there's a lot of work going into this. There's a lot of research and a lot of sort of watching how patients are doing and trying to figure out what is the safest, best thing to do when someone has an aneurysm. And you would think that if someone has an aneurysm, that you would just fix it. There's some way to fix it. You know, if you have an aneurysm, it should either be clipped or coiled. And I'll talk just in a second about what those two, you know, procedures mean. But really, you know, like any medical procedure or medication or test that we do, you know, there is some risk associated with that. And especially when we're talking about treating the blood vessels in and around the brain, you know, there's quite, sometimes quite a bit of risk that can happen if we try and fix something before it causes a problem. And so the what a lot of people will do is if they find an aneurysm, this is especially true if it's less than 5 millimeters in size, and that's how good our scanners are now. We can find aneurysms that are very small. Sometimes it's safest just to watch and make sure that nothing changes. They'll rescan and look again to make sure that the aneurysm isn't growing. And if an aneurysm has grown by even just 1 millimeter from one scan to the other, they consider that an expanding aneurysm, and that might mean that it requires treatment. But depending on the size of the aneurysm, where it is in the brain, like you mentioned, you know, if it's a very big aneurysm, it might even be easier to treat because it may be in a place where they can get to it a little bit with less risk. You know, it may need to get treated with clipping or coiling. And so the difference between those two ways of treating, a clipping of an aneurysm is where they'll actually do open surgery. They'll make some opening in the skull, whether it's large or small, depending on where the aneurysm is. And then they'll go down to where the aneurysm is, and they'll put a little clip at the base of the aneurysm to essentially keep blood from flowing into it. And then that will treat that aneurysm, and it really greatly reduces the risk of bleeding. A coiling of an aneurysm is where they'll take what we call an endovascular approach. It's very similar to how people have stents put in their heart. A small catheter will be fed into the aorta that goes up into the brain then. And when they get up into the brain, they can put these small, often platinum coils inside the aneurysm. And what that does is it causes a blood clot to form inside the aneurysm and, again, keeps the blood from flowing into the aneurysm and reduces the risk of bleeding there. Those are two very different approaches to treating an aneurysm, and really it depends on your specific aneurysm, how big it is, where it is, what the shape of the aneurysm is, and also some of your other medical risk factors. Maybe someone is a very high risk for a big open surgery because they have other problems like heart disease or other organs are having trouble. And then in that case, maybe the coiling will be a little bit better. It really depends on that individual, you know, sort of characteristic of the aneurysm and the patient. And so what's really important is to get a proceduralist, often a neurosurgeon or an interventional radiologist who's been trained, or an interventional neurologist trained in treating aneurysms these ways, and for them to watch and talk with you and sit down in clinic and look at the scans and get the follow-up scans they need and really consider all the options and figure out what is the safest. But it is a lot of people have aneurysms where we just watch with scans, with follow-up scans, everything is very stable and the risk of bleeding seems to be very low.
Mm. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate that question. We'll go to Peter in Pewaukee next. Hi, Peter.
Good afternoon, Larry and Dr. Bradbury. My daughter-in-law works for a Cook Medical Company, and what her job is to sell, but then to train surgeons to use this device. It allows them to operate on the aneurysm with far less problem in the actual bleed becoming uncontrollable. I don't know too much about it. I was just wondering if Dr. Bradbury could explain more.
So it allows the surgeon to sort of surround the aneurysm so it can be operated on. Is that correct, Peter?
That is my my belief of how she explained it to me, but
I understood.
I'm not familiar with that exact device or treatment procedure there, but I know that there have been several advances, and this is probably one of them, where the ability to treat safely aneurysms has gotten much better over the last several years, and that's both with open surgeries with the clipping I just described and the coiling. For example, sometimes people have in their aneurysm, you can think of it like a balloon coming off of the artery, and sometimes they have a very narrow opening that goes into the aneurysm and makes coiling very easily, and then sometimes it's a much wider opening into the aneurysm that makes clipping a little bit easier, although now sometimes even those can be coiled with what they call stent-assisted coiling and other, you know, techniques. And so I'm very excited about, you know, the new procedures and the new devices that are coming out. I'm hoping that what we'll see eventually, because the mortality rate from aneurysm rupture has been fairly stable for quite some time now. And so what I'm really hoping to see as these new devices and techniques come out on the market and they're able to be implemented on a larger, you know, scale, we'll see that risk of dying from your aneurysm rupture go down because they'll be easier treated. And, you know, back to the screening question,
yeah,
people who have aneurysms found, there'll be safer options to be able to prevent them from that aneurysm from bleeding in the future.
Peter, thank you so much. Appreciate the call. Dennis in Dubuque, Iowa, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Dennis.
Yeah, thanks, Larry and Dr. Luke. Hey, I've been a smoker since before I was a teenager, and up until, well, I'm still smoking, and I don't promote that. But I quit smoking, and I start getting, when I was laying down, I get dizziness. Or if I go out in the garden, bend over, I got dizziness. I started smoking again, and it kind of went away. I only get that every now and then. I mean, it's like a real dizziness, like you're going to faint or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, it's really hard to know. Dizziness is a what we call a fairly non-specific symptom. In other words, a lot of different things can cause dizziness. But you know, certainly when you quit, and someone quits smoking, there's all kinds of things that happen in your body, as not just the nicotine, but all of the other, as you know, probably know, there's thousands of chemicals that end up in your blood when you smoke tobacco. And when you quit that and your body has to adjust to being off of that regular exposure to the tobacco smoke, I think people can have a lot of symptoms, and certainly dizziness and unsteadiness may be one of them. It's definitely something I would recommend you talk to your doctor about so that they can look into other causes of dizziness if that, you know, is something that you're worried about. But it really raises an important point, because there's a lot of factors that go into the risk of an aneurysm bleeding. And there's two main what we call modifiable risk factors. In other words, those are risk factors that we can affect to reduce the risk of an aneurysm actually bleeding or growing or even developing in the first place. And one of the biggest ones is smoking. So if someone smokes, their risk of developing a rupture from an aneurysm is about 3 times higher than someone who does not smoke. And so that's a really big one. If you can quit smoking, that risk goes down over time. And so it's really important. And I know this is really hard. I've talked to patients, you know, hundreds of patients over the years. Quitting smoking is very, very difficult. And there are other options. There's both medications. There's patches, there's nicotine replacement therapies like patches and gum. But there's a lot of options now, and maybe one of them has come out since you last tried, and it's worth talking to your primary doctor about to do that. The other big modifiable risk factor that we need to talk about is high blood pressure, and that's something that can be treated. And if it is treated and the blood pressure is brought down to a normal range, the risk of developing or having an aneurysm rupture is much lower. And really, you know, it's like plumbing. You know, if you have these pipes that are carrying blood in your head, if the pressure inside those pipes is very high, the risk of injuring them and then developing aneurysms or an aneurysm rupturing is much higher than it is if you have normal pressure. And so if you have high blood pressure, make sure that's treated, see your primary doctor, and get on the, you know, often medications that will help bring that down into a healthy range.
Dennis, thank you. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Lori in Spooner, on to you. Hi, Lori.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have, while I was on the line with your receptionist, I may have missed the treatment for abdominal aneurysm. Is that the same as a brain aneurysm? And my husband's aneurysm at this point is 4.8. Tell me if there's a different treatment.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so at 4.8, the cutoff that a lot of people will use to decide if an aneurysm is at a higher risk of bleeding or not is 5. And so it sounds like they're following it very, very closely if it's at 4.8, and that needs to be watched. But, you know, there are a lot of other things in cerebral aneurysms that go into whether or not that needs to be treated. And so, you know, the shape of it, exactly where it is inside the brain are all things that they're going to need to consider there. Now, abdominal aortic aneurysms.
It sounds like his may be in an abdomen.
Okay, so if it's in his abdomen, yeah, the treatment is very different. And there's, it's actually, I guess, sort of similar in that there are two, you know, from what I understand, there are two main, you know, ways to treat abdominal aneurysm. One is like an open surgical correction. That's a major surgery that where they go into the abdomen and they try and correct it. But then they can also do an endovascular surgery where they put a very large stent inside, or, you know, kind of a covered stent inside the aneurysm to try and prevent it from growing anymore and reduce the risk of bleeding. The vascular surgeons who do that are the experts in it and can speak much more to it than I can. But it is definitely something, especially people with a history of smoking, need to get followed and get routine scans, because if it does get to a point where it's at a higher risk of hemorrhage, they may need to do that surgery and address it.
Lori, good luck to you and your husband. Thank you so much for calling. Polly in Richland Center. Hi, Polly. Thanks for calling.
Good afternoon. I am so happy that we're talking about this today. I lost my younger sister to a very large aneurysm, suddenly ruptured, and she literally dropped over dead. And my GP suggested that I get a scan, and I did, and lo and behold, I have an aneurysm. And mine was successfully coiled at St. Mary's Hospital with Dr. Chris Baggett. Huge shout out to the team over there. Wonderful, wonderful job. And I go in routinely for checkups after being coiled. Lo and behold, my other sister diagnosed with an aneurysm as well and ended up over at UW, where she got just incredibly good treatment as well. So if there is any doubt in anyone's mind that this is not familial, guess again. And it only takes, it's painless to get the MRI, and they walk you through everything. It can be scary, but boy, the team really does so much to waylay your fears, and it's a life-saving procedure. So shout out to anybody that has somebody in their family with an aneurysm, get checked.
That's absolutely true. And thank you so much for that story. I'm sorry about your sister, but I'm really glad to hear that you and your other sister have had these aneurysms treated now. And, you know, so Dr. Baggett is wonderful over at St. Mary's. He actually was a resident when I started my job here at UW, and I know him well. He's a great doctor. And it's the team at UW as well. So there's a lot of great places here in Madison, and I'm sure all over the state, to get these things done. And it's really great to hear that. I would also, it reminded me that there is a stroke and aneurysm support group that we have through the UW and Meritor hospitals, but really anyone can join in. And I think we're going to hopefully put a link to that on the webpage. So if anyone's interested, it's great for people who've had aneurysms and survived them or other strokes, and also their family members and friends who would like to meet with others who have gone through similar experiences. Sometimes being able to share your story and talk about these things can really help alleviate some of the anxiety you might have around these things. So.
And it's my understanding that these are online, can be online, so people could join from anywhere?
That's exactly right. It was, you know, there's some of the things that happened with the pandemic were a little bit of a blessing in disguise, in that we moved that to an online forum so that people can join remotely. It makes it a lot easier, especially if someone has disability from a prior aneurysm or stroke. You know, they can join, via, a remote computer access there, and it makes it a lot easier to join there. So.
Yeah, and we have that up on our page. So if you go to ideas@wpr.org/Larry and just go to today's program, we'll have it we have it now, I believe, in our program notes. Or they could go to UW Hospitals.
Absolutely. If you go to the UW Hospital website and just search stroke support group or stroke and aneurysm support group, you'll find a link there.
Okay. Well, let's go to Kate in Wisconsin Rapids next. Hi, Kate.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a question. My daughter, who was born in 1990 and was immediately misdiagnosed with this blotch she had on her back. They said it was a hemangioma, and this was out in Los Angeles, and then had an MRI here in Marshfield that also read it as a hemangioma when she was six. It turned out when she hit puberty, we went to Children's, and I thought it was a superficial hemangioma. It turns out it was an AVM, and a very large one, 17 centimeters across her low back by about 9 centimeters. And we were sent to Alejandro Berenstein, who is an endovascular interventional radiologist back in Los Angeles, and multiple procedures where they clotted it off and then removed it and then had to repeat it. She's been fine since. My concern has been, having been an ICU nurse, and I only knew AVMs from being in the spine or the brain, where I guess the majority of them are, what are the risks that she could have an AVM in her brain?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. It's hard to know if this was a spontaneous AVM that was...
AVM is...
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, so an AVM stands for arteriovenous malformation. And what that means is generally is the blood comes out of the heart. It goes through the arteries, and then it goes to these very small vessels called capillaries, where the gas exchange happens, where, you know, it leaves off oxygen and takes up carbon dioxide. And then after the capillaries, it flows into the veins, which then go back to the heart and the lungs and restart that circulation. And what an AVM is, where that capillary phase is missing. And so the blood flows directly from an artery into a vein. And that means that the pressure from the high pressure artery side goes right into the veins, which are not really supposed to have that kind of pressure. And it can grow and become a sort of tangle of blood vessels. There is also a risk for bleeding. And cerebral AVMs, you know, that happen in and around the brain are very similar to aneurysms. And the risk of bleeding is significant. And so the treatment for those, if they're found, is also the same. You know, it's hard to know if she has not had any neurological problems, any brain symptoms. You know, it would it's hard to know if she has an AVM or not, but I would guess probably it's a fairly low risk. But it might be worth, you know, if she knows that there is a connective tissue issue that might lead to the development of AVMs. You know, it's certainly a screening scan, if it's normal now, would be very reassuring. But if it did show an AVM, it might warrant treatment someday.
Kate, thank you so much for calling. And Dr. Bradbury, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. And if you want that support group, or if you want to learn some more about aneurysms, you can go to that UW website. I know there's information there to help you out. And we'll get Dr. Bradbury back and we'll do it again. Luke Bradbury, neurologist at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.